You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and tonight I've rented Escape to Victory. Watching with me is Mr. Football Clichés himself, Adam Hurry. Hi, Adam, how are you?
Hello, Rich. I'm all right, thanks.
Welcome to the Video Club. This is a very special film we've bonded over. What's so special about Escape to Victory for you?
I think before we get into the kind of glorious specifics and the nuts and bolts of Escape to Victory, I think it's important that we place it in the cinematic universe. I think, like a lot of the films you've covered on this podcast, it's one that some people will know completely by heart, that they've probably watched 100 times in their lives, and yet they would never choose to watch it at any given time. It's gone beyond curiosity. It's just something they wouldn't choose to watch. But crucially, if it's on TV, they would feel obliged, like, you know, like properly duty bound to watch it. So the same goes for Rocky or Indiana Jones or anything like that. You wouldn't, if you had the DVD, you probably wouldn't fish it out and watch it, you know, out of choice. But when it's on telly, there's a completely different impulse to watch it. And that's where Escape to Victory sits. It sits among that sort of film. And also, it is a Christmas film. Now, I don't tend to get involved in the debate of what constitutes a Christmas film, but I will make a case for this simply because it's on ITV4 every December, and that's the qualification threshold for me.
That works. I mean, we're recording this, just to date this completely horribly, just before Christmas 2020, and I've got a copy of the Radio Times here. I'm half tempted to rip it open and see when it's on. Mm. I mean, we're in a position where, you know, it's the annual debate about Die Hard and stuff, but it's like, yeah. I mean, for me, I mean, maybe a Christmas thing, I'm not sure, but it is that bank holiday.
Yes.
It's template. It's, you know, there's a Bond 100%. Film, there's The Sound of Music, and then Escape to Victory Building. And it'll always, I mean, in my life, I always turn on to it around the time that Kevin O'Callaghan's arm gets broken. And it's always around that time you turn on and you think, oh, well, that's me for the next hour then, isn't it?
Yeah. And actually, that's a good point. It's a film that you could pretty much join at any stage of it being on telly, and you wouldn't feel, oh no, I've missed the best bit, or you know, I feel like it's too late to join this train. There's pretty much any stage of that film you could watch it and enjoy whatever's left. But as a premise, it's just it's a fascinating concept. It's just the right side of being too ridiculous. The whole thing is very, very workable and watchable, and yet quite clearly could never have possibly happened. So I think it has all the ingredients of a bank holiday, nothing better to do film.
No, and again, when you put the sum of the parts together, I mean, if you sit down and you want to watch a film on a bank holiday, it's directed by the director of Annie, The African Queen, and the original Casino Royale.
Exactly.
Starring Michael Caine, Max von Sydow, Sylvester Stallone. You think, this is an epic voyage, which also includes John Walk, European Cup winner.
The dubbed over John Walk, yeah.
It's difficult to put into context how many players played both a Nazi team in World War II and were on the receiving end of that 9-0 defeat at Old Trafford. And yet this film includes everything. That I mean, watching it again, it's the first time I watched it all the way through the other night in probably... Right. 15, 20 years, to be honest, because I always do flick onto it just before the game kicks off. Mm-hmm. And it is crazy when you look at the logistics of it now. And if, I mean, this is 40 odd years ago.
Yeah.
And you've got, I mean, you've got Bobby Moore and Pele, who had retired. They're in their early 40s.
Yeah.
And you've got Michael Caine, who's in his late 40s, I think 47, 48.
Okay.
Still pretending to be a current West Ham and England defender.
John Colby, which I think is just about a convincing enough name for a early 1940s footballer. Whereas on the other hand, Bobby Moore's character is called Terry Brady. Now, if you're getting really technical about this, if we're getting proper IMDb goofs about this, England didn't actually cap a Terry until the early 1960s. So that's always annoyed me that someone, you know, a high-level English footballer in the early 1940s would be called Terry, because it's just, that just wouldn't happen. I'm not saying they weren't Terrys. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that they weren't popularised at the high level of football. It's an important point, but there are so many little details in Escape to Victory that were kind of glossed over, and which I think stops it being a great film. It was the attention to detail, basically.
And I guess, when you look at these, I mean, they did film the whole thing in Hungary because, again, if you're in the early 80s, and I don't know, I mean, whether the Hungarian government had some sort of tax credit thing or they'd just done their scouting really well. And they've decided that a top division Hungarian stadium looks like the sort of ground they'd have played in Paris in the 40s.
Yeah, and it's not far off.
I mean, it's all these technicalities. And weirdly, one of the things I looked at was that they had to look for a stadium that didn't have floodlights.
Of course.
And I don't see why. I mean, bear in mind that our local ground that we go to games at also doesn't have floodlights. I mean, they could have filmed it in South West London, but
that would have been amazing if they'd filmed it at Green Lane, Worcester Park. Yeah.
Yeah, get Aussie Ardeers down. I mean, but and to also include Aussie Ardeers, current world champion at this point. And I'd argue probably at the peak of his career. I think he'd have 81, they won the cup with Spurs, I think.
Yeah, so he's one of the few footballers in that film who you could justifiably say was at or near their peak, their playing career. But of course, his character is another one of those kind of slightly fudged technicalities, because he's not Argentine in the film. In fact, his nationality isn't referenced at all. Wikipedia, that oracle of all things nationalities in Escape to Victory, suggests he's either Mexican or Costa Rican, which is a very precise dilemma, because apparently Argentina was mostly neutral during the war. And this goes on to other characters. Pelé's character, Luis Fernandez, is not Brazilian. He makes one reference to growing up in Trinidad, so we all assume he must be therefore Trinidadian, because Brazil didn't get involved in the war until 1943. And this film appears to have been set in 1941-ish. So that there's things that they did kind of try and get right, but haven't actually kind of explained why, if you know what I mean.
And it's interesting when you look at it in the concept of now. And I mean, one of the things we spoke about before we talked about doing this was if it was a contemporary film, and you're looking at it, and we're in an age of conscription, so obviously you've got a current West Ham and England player is in a prisoner of war camp. You've got the major from the Nazis is a former German international. It's the equivalent of someone's like, I don't know, Guido Buchwald is now senior in the Nazi party and is talking to Stuart Pearce about playing a friendly game of football during what would be, I don't know, be, without making this too political, something, a war about Brexit or something. And having all this stuff where everyone used to be, oh, I knew you. They had the little meeting over their beer. I remember you, you know, when another former international comes in. It's an old boys club.
I don't think there's any, I mean, we're kind of bound to say this about any film that we like, and the prospect of it ever being remade, but I can't think of any modern context in which it would be as cool. And I can't think of any remake that would be not shit. I mean, there have been so many mooted remakes of this film. In 2010, Vinnie Jones was reported to be in talks with David Beckham taking the Bobby Moore role. And the Sun quoted a Hollywood source as declaring that the original footballer's acting skills were so wooden they wouldn't have looked out of place in IKEA. And the latest development, if you can call it that, is the director of The Commuter, possibly the one with Liam Neeson in on a train.
Oh, yeah.
Jaume Colet-Serra was apparently in line to direct yet another mooted remake. That was as of 2019. But as always with these things, it just goes very quiet. So I imagine it's just got secretly panned. But even if you, whatever list of current footballers or recently retired footballers you put together to make this film again, it would not be good. And the only concession I'm prepared to make here is that it would introduce a whole new generation of football fans to this fantasy world, this fantasy concept, and then they would take it from there. And that's kind of fine. But anybody who enjoys this film would never enjoy a remake, and that is fact.
Well, no, because you look at any film that involves football generally is dreadful anyway. I mean,
completely.
On the Three Amigos episode I did with Graham Sibley, we talked about Goal and how the baddie from the Three Amigos was the dad of the guy in Goal.
Oh, wow.
Which was mind-blowing. I didn't know that.
That is mind-blowing.
And when you think about the historical context, I mean, the the match took place about 40 years before this film was made. So therefore, if you're talking 40 years previous to this, you're talking either a Cold War, the Falklands, something like that. And then
the Cold War would be kind of fairly intriguing backdrop to any remake, I suppose. That wouldn't be terrible. But it would be, again, it would be very one-dimensional. You'd have sort of robotic Soviet Lobanovsky trained opposition, and you'd end up with Rocky IV as a football game, wouldn't you? Which is actually quite good sounding.
Yeah, I was about to say I'd buy my ticket now.
Yeah, sounds all right. But as you say, football films are generally pretty rubbish, and the reason they're rubbish is kind of two things, really. First of all, any attempt to just kind of approximate something that lots of people love deeply is never going to hit the mark with the majority of them. They all have their own things that they know intrinsically about football. And if you try and approximate that, it will always jar. And the second thing is that football action itself is incredibly difficult to film convincingly and choreograph and stage. And then after all that, get a bunch of actors, even if they are footballers, to act it out exactly as you wish. So football action is intrinsically difficult to turn into a compelling film. But despite saying all of that, Escape to Victory is probably right at the top of examples where the action is quite convincing. Some of the Allied goals are really scrappy, and that's the point. Quite a lot of goals in actual football are quite scrappy, quite untidy, quite imperfect, and film directors just don't seem to get that. I mean, even the winning goal at the end, given that it is indeed Pelé, I suppose is actually quite fitting. And so there aren't any sort of cartoonishly stupid goals throughout this game, which is a huge selling point, albeit quite a subtle one.
No, and I must point out, because you can always rely on the people of Twitter, the good people of Twitter, to come back if you make a factual mistake. And I think it was Pelé turned 70 quite recently. 70 or 80? 80?
I'm saying 80.
It must have been 80. So he turned 80 recently, and I posted a picture of him on the set of Escape to Victory with all the Nazi flags in the background. And it was something along the lines, here's a photo of Pelé beating the Nazis. And someone said, I think you'll find the match ended as a 4-4 draw.
Oh, yes, of course.
And proceeded to explain to me, long after I'd muted him, that the match wasn't a victory, and why did they call the film Victory and after all?
It's a perfectly good question. And I don't really see why they didn't have them winning it. I mean, you've gone so far with this concept, you might as well have them win the game. I don't see how making it a 4-4 draw somehow makes it suddenly a more well-rounded masterpiece. There's no narrative reason why the Nazis should not get beaten in a football match. There's no need to be balanced here. I don't know. Maybe you could argue it makes it slightly more. And then the fact that it's called Victory in America and Escape to Victory elsewhere just makes it even more silly, really. So yeah, it should have been 5-4, and I don't think anybody would have thought any less of it as a result.
No, but I suppose if you're celebrating a 4-4 draw, like again with my football hat on, that Arsenal Newcastle game a few years ago, I suppose you would celebrate as a victory. And I guess if they were smuggled out of the stadium, so they made good their escape. Then maybe that was the real victory, and we're all winners.
Yeah, I suppose that the word victory is supposedly meant in a more meta sense, but I don't think the war suddenly ends. I don't think this is parallel universe where the war has simply ended because this football game didn't quite go the way the Nazis wanted it. But you know, it is fundamentally a good game of football filmed very well, regardless of the context in which it takes place, regardless of the absurd cast and crew on the face of it that participate in it. And I think the whole thing is rubber stamped by the fact that I once watched Escape to Victory in a cinema in Islington, and right towards the end there was a shout from the back, and it was a very probably half cut Andy Gray who simply shouted, "Come on, Pelé!" right at the end. And that capped it off. And that's the only thing, that's the thing that will stay in my brain until I die.
I can imagine watching that for the first time, coming out in 1981. And if you're particularly an Ipswich Town fan, when half of your first team squad are in the film,
Yeah, in one form or another. Some of them are Nazis, which is a bit weird. And then, some of them are low-key, dubbed-over, heroic allies. John Walk only found out his Glaswegian accent was dubbed over when he went to the premiere, which must have been a terrible, terrible moment. And so he got to the premiere and realised he'd been dubbed over with what he described as a posh Scottish accent. And the guy you mentioned earlier, Kevin O'Callaghan, who was a winger for Ipswich, got roped in as the original goalkeeper for the Allies. And he, of course, had to have his arm broken so that Stallone could slide into the team. So that was the convenient thing. And so not only did he suffer the indignity of being played out of position and then forcibly injured, they then spelt his name wrong in the credits at the end. A hammer blow.
I mean, it's not often you put John Walk and Darth Vader in the same sentence, but of course that happened with Darth Vader as well, yes. That the actor found out he'd been dubbed at the premiere. Mm. And when you look at this in that context about the changes that they made, and I mean, we touched on earlier that because the game ended in a draw, what were the stakes? And again, I go to that Bible IMDb, the trivia, and it had the original draft, and this was a serious drama. There was no lightheartedness at all. And I think the ultimate stakes were if the Nazis won, the prisoners would be released in Switzerland. If the prisoners won, they'd all be shot. And towards the end of the game, the prisoners went, come on, lads, we can win this. And went for glory and were all murdered at the end of the film.
I mean, there are some aspects of this film, as I've said, which are kind of glossed over and they're unexplained. For example, Robert Hatch, who is Sly Stallone's character, is overtly American, very obviously American, and is referred to as an American at least a couple of times, I think. But this is presumably, if the timeline is correct, a good few months before Pearl Harbor. So again, without any explanation whatsoever, he is introduced as an American who's enlisted in the Canadian Army. And that's apparently how they get through that loophole. And but, you know, as with all these things, there is always going to be someone out there who will pick up on absurd little technicalities in these films, and especially when it comes to wartime stuff. If you get anything wrong with a wartime film, people will pick up on it. But among the goofs on IMDb for Escape to Victory is possibly the most pedantic goof I've ever seen. And this is how it goes. He says, the microphone used by the radio announcer at the soccer match is an RCA model 77B, a model not introduced until the late 1940s. So they got the microphone wrong by about 6 years, which feels really, really harsh. All sorts of things that they haven't really paid a great deal of attention to, but that one feels like the harshest.
And I mean, again, this is one of these things, maybe I'd been not educated properly as a young man. I'd never seen The Great Escape until 3 or 4 years ago, sort of in full anyway. I mean, my dad was more into Clint Eastwood than Steve McQueen, but, and I didn't realize the similarities between, you know, this and certainly the first half of this. You know, you've got the American who is the escape king, always trying to get out. And there's this whole, and I guess it's the whole subplot thing, because you can't just have 90 minutes of build up for a football match. I mean, this isn't Sky Sports. And you've got Hatch or Stallone and his convoluted plan to escape. And then he's told, no, you've got to go and speak to this French fella. And then ultimately he gets out, speaks to this French fella, and then they say, oh, you've got to be recaptured.
Yeah.
And he's not a team player. And by the sounds of it, he wasn't much of a team player in filming either. No. I mean, the whole way that this was done, and I mean, again, if you're Michael Caine, this is just a big jolly.
Completely.
You know, he said he wanted to meet Pelé, and that was the whole reason he did it.
Yeah, Caine said he really liked Sly Stallone, but during any breaks in filming, they would just jump on a plane and just fly off to somewhere much more glamorous than deepest, darkest Hungary, and just go and get pissed somewhere. So it'd been Paris one time, and Prague the next, or something like that. And so it sounds like they had an incredible time. Stallone, legend has it, also took on Man Mountain Ipswich player Kevin Beattie, who I think was his role in the film was Michael Caine's body double during some of the football scenes. And they had an arm wrestle on set, and Kevin Beatty beat Sly Stallone in an arm wrestle, which just sounds like several layers of unbelievable, but I'm going with it because it sounds really good.
I mean, this is the thing as well, when Stallone at this point, he'd come off the first two Rocky films, but nothing else he'd done had done well. So this was, I think, the year before the first Rambo film had come out. And he's obviously driven by this ego.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, he's written Rocky and got Oscar nominations and this and that. And he's still coming into this off the back of numerous flops,
yeah,
other than a Rambo film, and still coming into this film. And there's the rumor that's probably true that he wanted to score the winning goal.
Yes.
Even as the goalkeeper.
I believe that probably happened. He strikes me as someone who doesn't care or know a lot about soccer, at least at that point in his life.
I've learned so much about this game and the way they're playing and the heat and everything, and Fort Lauderdale is playing a very aggressive game, so it's quite interesting to watch. And I was so ignorant about this game up until I met Pelé about 18 weeks ago.
And it strikes me as something very conceivable that he said, can I be the one who scores the winning goal? And they were just like, no, it just doesn't work. And the way that they gave him the crowning moment, you know, saving that penalty in the last minute that could have made it 5-4, albeit a very crap penalty, a very good height for the goalkeeper. Mm. I think it was nicely done. I think it works very well. And it's always a bit of a minefield, this concept of casting an American character who doesn't know about football, because there is always that stereotype to wrestle with. But by and large, he doesn't look like a star actor who's been shoehorned into a production at all. I think his role it adds a nice little angle to the whole film, frankly. The faff about him escaping and then getting recaptured is possibly the clunkiest part of the film, but it doesn't really bring it down.
I don't think many people watch this film for the subtleties of the plot and anything about espionage, do they?
But as you say, they have to build up to the match somehow. And I do think, obviously, whilst the match is the crescendo of the film, just like the final fight in any of the Rocky films is the way that those films climax, it still ticks along very nicely. And the way that the match is kind of negotiated between Carl von Steiner and John Colby, it's all done fairly well, even though obviously the whole idea is preposterous.
I mean, it's enjoyable watching now, the, you know, the little things and you know, everything now, you know, when I grew up watching football in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, things have changed so much since then. And you look back at the 40s and Michael Caine's point, well, we want proper kit, you know, we want our proper boots, and they come out with these big hobnailed old
great kit. It is a great kit.
I mean, it's iconic. Yeah. And it's, you know, I mean, you know, even now, I mean, if we remember, was it Dream Team on Sky? And it was a similar premise. I mean, I remember one game in that where did they play at a cup final at the old Wembley, and there was a sniper in the scoreboard like that.
Right, okay.
And it was one, and it, again, that was let down massively by the quality of the filming of the football scenes.
Yes, absolutely.
And watching it now, and you're sitting here thinking, it's strange that they managed to get these players. And it is like, it was a bit Sunday League, wasn't it? You know, you've got Michael Caine, late 40s, massive belly, cajoling, and clearly, I mean, Ozzy Ardili said he couldn't run 20 yards.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly not a footballer. And yeah, Ardiles was the most damning of his teammates in terms of his physical condition. But he doesn't look like an unconvincing, recently retired 40s footballer. I mean, he looks pretty much like, you know, a 66th World Cup winner. He looks just like Bobby Moore does. And so they kind of carry each other through the film, I think, in their respective expertise.
They're a little double act, those two.
Yeah.
And then when you add the sort of the other parts, I mean, especially as the game, as the momentum swings back towards the Allies. And of course, we've got the dodgy ref and all these unpunished fouls and so on. You know, you've got to have increased the odds somewhat, don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, some of the rough and tumble aspect of it is fairly well done. The way Pelé gets injured is not spectacular. It's a fairly innocuous incident. Stallone getting kicked in the face as he wrestles for the ball on the floor, that's pretty good. And so, yeah, some of the tackles are genuinely, without being, you know, X-rated, they are very authentically clumsy and cynical. So pretty much every aspect of the game, despite the fact it's not a very long football game in the film, it's all done very quickly. It's just all really convincing to watch. I think that's a huge aspect of the film, is that it's not silly. That's why it has longevity for me. And that's why I will always hold it up as a very good film. It's because it isn't, we're not talking about comic book football. It's actually really, really well shot. But no one will ever talk about that because it's actually, you know, who cares?
I mean, the whole thing with this very, very slow motion clip of Ozzy Ardiles is doing that. Was it a sombrero? I think they call it that.
A rainbow flick. Yeah, rainbow like flick. Yeah, I mean, that's absurd. I mean, that would not have happened in 1941, no matter which country he came from, Mexico or Costa Rica. It's an artistic flourish. The chance to use a bit of slow motion completely unnecessary short corner routine where he sort of flicks it up with a rainbow flick. Someone heads it back to him and then he chests it down. Not the most useful bit of play, but looks nice. And that's the most important thing.
I mean, it's the thing about the production values of the film. I mean, they've obviously chucked a lot of money at this. You've got, you know, very, very well-known director in charge. And I guess this must have been deliberate to make it fit in with some element of credibility. They've got the music is by Bill Conti, who did the first Rocky movie. And there is, you know, you can tell by the prisoner of war set that this is an attempt to make it look like a genuine wartime film.
Oh, completely. I mean, one thing I've always said about it is it doesn't feel like an 80s film. I mean, it's 81, so yeah, barely in that decade, but it doesn't feel like a kind of bombastic in your face 70s/80s action film at all. Its spirit is very much 40s and 50s wartime film, and not just because of its setting. I think the way that all the actors behave is exactly as you would have expected in The Great Escape, for example, or anything that came before that. So it is in its tone quite wartime anyway. So I'm glad about that, because it would have been a little bit jarring to see a kind of 80s style, Rambo style World War II film.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing where you put things in a more contemporary setting where, I mean, I guess a close companion of this would be Mean Machine.
Yeah.
The Vinnie Jones, Jason Statham one from 20 years ago. I mean, that was a remake in itself of The Longest Yard. And you think now, if they made it now, it would be CGI heavy. Yeah. It would be, and again, like you said, David Beckham earlier, and if they made this now, of course Beckham would be in it because... Of course he would be.
Yeah, I mean, the fear I would have about this film being made now is the fact that there would be so many commercial concerns. All the players involved would have their own various image rights and things that their entourages would need included in the film. There would be, you know, branded boots everywhere. The focus would be completely different. And if anything, Beckham would probably be one of the better people to have in it, because as much of a commercial machine as he is, he wasn't known for having a particularly unrealistic way of playing football. You know, all he'll be doing is whipping in free kicks and crosses. That's fine. Maybe he'll take a free kick in the last minute or something like that. But at least his contribution would be realistic. If you had someone like Neymar, they would get him doing something really silly that even he wouldn't have done in an actual football game. And I fear that the whole thing would just look really silly. And you know, the way they're shooting films these days, you know that they would frame it in such a absurd way, and it just wouldn't be as honest and authentic and nice as the original film. And that's I don't care how old that makes me sound.
I mean, funnily enough, I actually asked on Twitter earlier on about if they made it now, and I had there was a screenshot of the actual starting 11.
Right,
who would you pick? And some of the names that have come back, and they are the ones that you just roll your eyes and go, oh, well, obviously. And there was either Channing Tatum or Gerard Butler in goal.
Actually, yeah, that's an interesting one.
Michael Caine's role would be Tom Hardy or Jason Statham. John Terry would turn up in full kit anyway. and then whoever plays for Ipswich these days.
Yes, true. I can't name the current Ipswich squad, so I'm not sure. I suppose it's the most compelling question is who would take on the Stallone role. Gerald Butler's got history when it comes to playing football. Football film was called, but he
was
played
the Ally McCoist one.
No, it was very similar, but much shitter. It was I'm pretty sure it's called Playing for Kicks or something like that. And he was a former Celtic striker who now lived in America, and he was trying to win his wife back or yeah, that standard thing. And it, yeah, it's really bad. So I'm not sure who would be the keeper. Statham would have to have a role somewhere, but yeah, it's I don't know. I mean, in terms of the current it doesn't have to be A-list footballers. It could be pretty much anybody. They could pick anybody. And I honestly fear that whoever they picked, it's going to be a shambles. But you know, the fact is that if 12-year-olds enjoy it, then that the cycle has simply begun again. So I suppose I would have to begrudgingly allow it.
I mean, I kind of wrote a couple of names, and you think if you look at, you know, you've got World Cup winners in there, you've got Pele, you've got Bobby Moore, and Ardiles at his peak. I mean, I suppose the equivalent now would be like Antoine Griezmann or someone like that, you know, and, God, with his weird hairstyles and that. And then the slightly older, you know, a Figo or a Cannavaro or something like that.
Maybe Zidane or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there are some charismatic footballers out there who could probably do a passable job. And as the footballers in the original demonstrate, you don't have to be a particularly good actor. I mean, Pelé's little cameos of acting aren't bad at all. The bit where he sort of goes to the chalkboard and implies that he's just going to dribble around the entire Nazis, do it all himself, is really, really nice.
You're in no condition to run for 90 minutes, I tell you. This especially applies to wingers. If you can't cross, don't run it through. Try and get a corner. A set piece works in our favour. Which means that, as they...
Give me this. Cool. After giving me ball, here I do this. Go. Easy.
And I don't know whether they asked him to put on a kind of Trinidadian accent, so it's hard to place it. Actually, speaking of his voice, during the promo for this film, he and Sly Stallone appeared at an NASL game in the US. I think it might even be like the final game or something like that. And they appeared at halftime on the coverage to talk about Escape to Victory, the film that was going to be released fairly soon. And the really odd thing about it is they both appear to have exactly the same voice. Another thing I ever really thought about, if you hear them in isolation, but when they're put together, Sylvester Stallone and Pelé have exactly the same voice.
Oh, wow.
Hmm.
That makes Rocky IV very different.
Yes, yes. If I can get to 1,000 goals, you can get to 1,000 goals.
And you know he counted this one in his total as well, didn't he?
Rightly so. I mean, yeah, again, another one of the mini myths of this film is that it only took one take for him to score that overhead kick at the end, which is clearly not true because it's pieced together with lots of different shots. You can just tell. But the final shot of it sailing past the goalkeeper is very nice indeed. And I suppose if you did need someone to nail a bicycle kick, I imagine Pelé's not a terrible man to have it. But at least it wasn't Michael Caine, belly out and everything.
I mean, growing up, when we were playing in the playground at primary school, and I guess this would have been late 80s, and if you tried an overhead kick, it was a Pelé.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because I assume because of this, because I mean, it's not like we had YouTube or anything to watch those highlights. Yeah. And
there is no other famous Pelé bicycle kick. No one has ever seen one, or at least it isn't in mainstream consciousness. So yeah, that could conceivably be the first bicycle kick that a whole generation of people has ever seen, because they weren't very commonplace in England at the time, obviously. And yeah, that could well be the first bicycle kick anyone ever saw in their lives.
And it became a thing. It was a Pelé, you know, not any of the great things he did. You know, I mean, we didn't have many football videos, and if I did, there were the Arsenal ones or something, but we didn't have, you know, the brilliant FIFA World Cup films or anything like that. You know, I've got them all now, but
yeah.
And you know, just things like that where it kind of becomes mainstream because of a film. You know, this is arguably the greatest player ever, and certainly probably was at this point. Mm. And yet, we're learning about him from a hokey film set in the 40s. But it's amazing that, you know, something like that from a film that, I mean, it wouldn't have made a difference to me. It was just people playing football. It was just It was on a bank holiday because there was no other football on.
I mean, that's a perfectly good selling point for the film, to be honest. If a film can take the best footballer who had ever lived at that point and who was pretty much world famous, and to embellish his myth and his legend even further, then that's a film doing its job incredibly well. And having said that, you know, even if no one had ever seen a bicycle kick before, and it is an outlandish way for someone to have scored the equalising goal, I maintain, as I've said several times in this podcast, that all of the action in the film is very authentic and convincing. So it still fits very well. So if that's the most outlandish thing that would happen in the entire game, that's fine by me.
One thing I had forgotten about, and maybe it's just more relevant now because of the last few months where we've had to watch football on TV with no fans and the piped in crowd noise. I forgot.
Yes, of course.
obviously, if the Nazis are playing in supposedly occupied Paris.
Yeah.
They're not going to be, it'll be a partisan crowd. It's not going to be cheering for them, is it?
The commentator himself is a fascinating figure. There's no explanation about who he is and who he represents. And why this terribly well-spoken English guy would be under the influence of the Nazis. There's no explanation about which broadcaster he's working for or anything like that. So that's all a bit strange. And then as for the crowd, as you say, are incredibly one-sided in reality. But then you get to the end, and another one of the oversights of the film is when they invade the pitch. A handful of them are wearing early 1980s Adidas tracksuits, which feels like something they probably could have policed beforehand, but couldn't be bothered. I respect anyone who does a job half-heartedly, and they clearly have done there.
I mean, this is one of the things, I guess, again, another damning indictment of early 1980s Hungary, where they've gone around, they're going, oh, don't worry about it, just turn up as you are.
Yeah. To make up for the occasional Adidas tracksuit, there are people sort of in massive overcoats of, you know, reasonably early 20th century origin. And that appears to be the limit but otherwise it's sideburns all over the shop. And some of the hairstyles need to be looked at again in terms of their authenticity. But yeah, I suspect they just gave up on the finer details at some point.
Yeah, I remember the film of Fever Pitch. They filmed it at Craven Cottage.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember because it was in the Arsenal programmes going, oh, if you want to go along and go to Fulham. And there were clearly a couple of then current Arsenal shirts in the background.
Yes.
So again, it was set 88, 89. Mm. They were wearing Nike sort of mid-90s oversized football shirts.
It's like, you just need one runner, one producer, whatever, to kind of just go through and say, no, 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 and take it off. And people are ruining films knowingly. Stop doing it.
But we're talking about it 20-odd years later. This is like the fella in Gladiator who was walking past in a pair of jeans.
I know what you mean. I'd be a huge stickler. I mean, I'd happily do the job. If they ever remake Escape to Vichy, I'd happily be the guy to go in and make sure that they are indeed wearing World War II authentic outfits, or Cold War, or wherever we're going to be setting this remake.
I think between us, we know several dozen people who'd be able to police if they did it set in the 80s or 90s.
Yeah, I just want a job on the new Escape to Vichy. That's all I want. That somehow I want a job on it.
We'll be the ones that I think you'll find that template wasn't worn by the USSR.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, one thing I also had was the, again, we're talking about it as though there's no escape in the Escape to Victory. Mm. The whole plot was that Stallone had organized with the resistance to escape the stadium at halftime digging out a hole in the bath and escaping through there from the sewers. Mm. And this is what was touched on in that kind of pride of the, we'd rather die and win the game.
Mm.
You know, it was 4-1 at halftime, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And it was 4-1 down at halftime. They're already in the tunnels.
Yeah.
I go, we can win this. We can beat them.
Come on, let's go. Come on.
I don't want to go. Let's go back. We can win this.
Who said that?
I did.
It's not as though we're being slaughtered, Skipper.
What do you mean we can win?
Wait a minute.
Corby, we're losing time.
You mean you go back and play the second half?
Well, I'll show you.
Let's move. We only got a few minutes.
Yes, but we can win this.
You can't win with me in the goal.
Of course we can. He's not a bad goalie, is he?
What the hell's the matter with you guys? You want to go back to prison?
We need you.
That's right.
You guys do what you want, but I'm leaving.
What we're doing is quitting.
I ain't going back to prison.
You've got to come back. If you don't come back, we can't go.
Hatch, if you go, we've all got to go with you. We can't go back without the goalie.
This is where Russell Osman and Mike Summerby get their one line of the entire film. It's like, come on, no, we can still do this. No, we can beat this line, no problem. And then, John Walk pipes up at that point and gets dubbed over. Yeah, Stallone is kind of one round to go back and play the second half. We shouldn't gloss over the fact that during the time that Stallone escapes from the camp to go and set all this up before the resistance sends him back to the camp to let everyone know it's all done, the implication is that he manages to squeeze in a relationship with his Parisian Airbnb host, whose husband is fighting the war somewhere else. The relationship is not visibly consummated, but there is an implication they have some sort of connection, and he becomes some sort of surrogate father to her tiny son as well. I can't confirm that this liaison happened, but it's heavily implied.
Well, it's just convenient that she looks very much like Adrian from the first Rocky film.
Yes, she does.
The young boy is probably crying out for a father figure. His name's like Pedro, so he runs on because he actually runs on with a bunch of flowers. They'll do it at halftime, Hatch.
Yeah, yeah. And that's before the stirring rendition of La Marseillaise, which is a really nice part of the film. I mean, stolen from Casablanca, clearly, but the crowd doing its job there, a very, very stirring rendition from a good, sizable football crowd. So that's nicely done.
I mean, much like Rocky IV, there was the crowd were as much involved as anything else, where they start. I mean, again, the crowd in this, they don't change allegiance halfway through because of the game, but they are the kind of the momentum barometer
that
follows
definitely.
Through.
Yeah. And also, another cinematic device which is used very well in Rocky IV, which is used again here, is the idea that even the baddest baddie can be impressed by the feats of the hero. So whereas in Rocky IV, you've got the Politburo standing up and applauding to varying levels of reluctance, you then have Carl von Steiner, who masterminded this game, who by and large is one of the nicest Nazis you'll ever witness. Just a generally quite good, decent bloke. Sort of stands up and applauds Pelé's equaliser. Well, most of his kind of other highly ranked Nazis around him look at him in disgust. So that's a nice touch. It's always a pleasant. It's the baddie being impressed and being forced to applaud at something the hero does, to me, is second only for heartwarming, recurring film moments to some sort of Mission Control Center bursting into applause. That will always get me. So yeah, Apollo 13, Armageddon, whatever you like, a bunch of scientists in a room with screens in front of them, suddenly standing up and applauding and crying. Wonderful.
Are you going to be branching out from football cliches into movie cliches anytime soon?
No, I'll be doing soap opera cliches first. That's my next, that's my next big project.
I mean, weirdly, the sort of two films either side of this that Max von Sydow did, he was Ming the Merciless and he was Blofeld in Never Say Never Again.
Really? Wow.
So he's clearly sort of tailored that overzealous villain role. He's gone from Ming to a Nazi to head of Spectre.
Fascinating trio of films in succession there. I mean, I don't know what Max von Sydow's football comprehension is like, but if he was indeed a keen football fan back then, I suspect this film was just a bit of a holiday for him. I mean, I think actors must get this every now and then between big projects or, arduous projects. They must just get offered something that just sounds really fun. I just think I'll take that. I mean, treading carefully here, dressing up as a Nazi for a few weeks probably is quite fun. I don't know.
I guess Nazi cosplay was all the rage. I mean, this is the same year Raiders of the Lost Ark came out as well.
So. As has been remarked upon many times over the years, they were very well dressed.
Are we the baddies?
Exactly.
When you say that, he is the connoisseur. He's the former German international who can appreciate this Trinidadian nobody who's come out, scored this winning goal.
I mean, he arrives at the start of the film sort of observing the prisoners of war just playing a kind of casual kickabout game in the camp. And at that stage, he's presented this kind of ominous Nazi figure. With a kind of that gruff exterior, but then his first interaction with Michael Caine's character—it's great. It's proper football man chat because they're like, I think I know who that guy, and then suddenly, Colby, John Colby, yes, West Ham United in England, and then it turns out they played against each other at Wembley. Oh wow, it's great. I suppose. It was never going to be the film that digs deep into this sort of thing, but it's possible that it's possible that professional footballers may have been fighting each other in the war, and then in the back of their minds going, do you know what, he did play centre half against me at Wembley, that must more seriously, careers that were put on hold by a global event for 5 or 6 years, and that careers that were never going to continue afterwards. It does touch upon the poignancy of that a little bit, if I'm really scraping the barrel.
This was the thing though, wasn't it? I mean, we missed World Cups. The football leagues were suspended all around the world. Mm. Michael Caine, the late 40s, Michael Caine's career, he was still hoping for a comeback and not just in one of these ITV2 Harry Redknapp gets all the lads back together specials.
Yeah.
He still looked better than Neil Ruddock, but
He was fed well in the concentration camp. He was fed well in the prison of war camp, that's for sure.
Yeah. He managed to get himself, as part of the deal, the extra rations and the beer and everything. He sorted himself out.
And a truckload of very problematically presented East Europeans. That again, one of those aspects of the film that is presented and then just left dangling and no one really talks about it. So,
This is the thing. I kind of looked at that and the weird thing is the way it was talked about was we do not recognize, because he had this list of players and obviously...
Officially, they do not exist.
Yeah. He had this list of players and I guess, even perhaps maybe in the in his playing career, he had an encyclopedic knowledge. Oh, the Norwegian.
Oh no, that bit's great. The bit where he basically comes up because he Michael Caine's character is having this kind of meeting with the Nazis in one of the posher parts of the camp, and he presents this list of players. You get the sense of a football man who's delved back through his brain for all the continental players that he's played against in Europe or whatever, and just thought, yeah, I need them as well. That's kind of cool, despite the fact they turned up as bags of bones.
I mean, that's the thing about how, he's now, everyone claims to know something about everyone. I mean, I I'll go off on a very slight tangent here. And one of my other things that I do is a blog about Finnish football, which... Mm. is inspired by this film because it's called Escape to Suomi.
And
the logo is very similar to the kit that the Allies wear. And I once tweeted something about there's a Finnish international son signed for Tottenham when he was 14 or 15. And it was just interesting because this was quite a famous former player. His son has a really weird name. It's Timo Tainio, whose son's name is Maximus. Which I think he was born just after Gladiator came out.
I thought he was named after someone from Escape to Victory or something.
Yeah, no, the other famous old war film. Right. And again, it was someone tweeting, go, oh yeah, I saw him play this tournament or whatever. And I'm like, bollocks. And again, this was, Michael Caine has obviously got this, oh yeah, the Norwegian fellow. It's just strange that he knows that these players must be interned somewhere.
Yeah.
And willing to play.
Yeah.
and they're in a reasonable state of fitness anyway. But one other thing I noted, and I was trying to be delicate here in how I phrased it, because this is either one of the less pleasant side of the films about the mistreatment of these people. And when he said, we do not recognize those countries. Mm. Now, you've probably sat through some of these UEFA and FIFA draws for competitions where certain countries can't play each other because they don't recognize.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, Russia can't play Kosovo because they don't exist.
Yeah.
Can't blame them if they don't exist.
Yeah, I don't think any of them make it onto the pitch in the end.
They're too emaciated, I think.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, they include Kazi Dana, who was pretty handy around the 80s, late 70s, 80s. So it's slightly disappointing that he didn't get a touch or two. I think he might have come
He's got the third goal.
Did he? Oh, no. Yeah. I'm not sure. The third goal, I'm pretty sure the third goal is the most scrappily filmed of all. And there is a bit of continuity situation about who actually scores it.
I think his character was...
Oh, is it Peter Wojciech? That's his character's name, isn't it? Of course. Yeah. Okay, so I will accept Dana as the scorer of the third goal. Yeah, it's like a rebound or something, like someone follows it up or something.
Oh yeah.
So it's brilliant. And that's how dramatic football goals go in a 4-4 draw. They're not all 30-yard screamers.
No, see, I didn't realise he played for Man City either.
Yeah.
Yeah, blimey. But yeah, I mean, as we discussed, the game ends, Pelé, who'd been injured earlier in the game, comes on, shows off an array of, in hindsight, quite pointless and tricks that don't progress the action at all.
That's probably the least realistic part, is when he's sort of going one-on-one against his arch nemesis, Werner Roth, who played with him at the Cosmos at that time, or just before that. And he's Baumann. He's the best player on the Nazi side. So they kind of go head to head in a little kind of one-on-one duel in the middle of the pitch, while all the other players sort of dance around them, which is a little bit silly, which always annoys me in football films when it gets reduced to kind of Bruce Lee style one-on-one situation where some people are just queuing up to fight them next. But other than that, it still stands up.
Yeah. Yeah, the Allies come back from 4-0 down.
Mm.
Pelé scores the super slow-mo several... he scores... There's one goal that's disallowed.
Yeah.
Then Pelé comes back on. And then that's the 4-4 with many, many, many super slow motions.
Mm.
And then the climactic action of the match, at least, is the penalty save.
Yeah, and it is a penalty as well. I mean, Ardiles slides in very recklessly.
Mm.
And, silly tackle to be making at 4-4 in the last minute. Quite frankly, no one ever talks about this as well.
You've got a point away from home. I mean,
yeah. I don't know. It's not neutral territory, is it? No, it's probably away. And
no away goals.
Yeah, and then, Baumann steps up, yeah.
And as you said, I mean, I've written poor penalty for me, Clive.
Yes, it is. It is. It's a poor penalty. I mean, it gets the slow motion treatment as well. So the camera is placed behind the ball. And even before he's kicked it, I mean, even a goalkeeper as inexperienced as Robert Hatch knows where that ball's going. He's opened up his body. There's no Panenka. There's no disguise here. It's a side-footed, very, very nice height for the goalkeeper, not even to the side. It's a very, very comfortable save. It just happens to be a very kind of photo-friendly save. Well, literally one for the cameras, quite literally. So, he's always saving that. If he doesn't save that, he'd be very disappointed with himself. But this is a goalkeeper who had to ask where to stand for a corner kick, of course.
Of course, but that was, I suppose, a humorous repeat throughout. But and I don't want to jump on the bandwagon too much, but even Italia 90 Peter Shilton might have made that one.
I think he would have just about got there.
Yeah. His refrain is normally, I went the right way. Mm. So I suppose for that one, he probably would have made it.
He'd have a lot to say about the dodgy referee, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you can't trust these lot.
No.
Yeah, not with his Daily Mail columns. And of course, this is the last kick of the game. Yep. Hatch saves the penalty and a full-on pitch invasion.
Yeah, by the laws of the game, if the game has finished, the referee will allow time for a penalty to be taken if one has been awarded. But it's always slightly jarring the fact that he saves the penalty and then with the ball in his hands, just really sort of clumsily boots it away without any sound of the final whistle, which I think that's quite a careless thing to do for a goalkeeper. Yeah. You never know when the game's finished or not. So it's a bit annoying that they don't have to, you know, the referee as any referee ought to wait for the ball to be kicked upfield in the safety of the centre circle and then declare the match over. That would have been the nicer way to do it. But yeah, whistle goes and they're all safely smuggled away in a fog of Adidas tracksuits, anachronistic Adidas tracksuits.
Yeah, get Michael Caine smuggled out over an old overcoat and everything.
We don't know their fate, of course. That's left entirely open to our imagination. All we see is them being smuggled out and that's it. That's the end of the film.
I suppose that the way that the Nazi officers were kind of looking a little bit fearful, I suppose implies that perhaps there was an attempt at a let's storm the box, sack the board type of thing.
Like West Ham and the Sullivan. What's his face? There is a slight implication, I think, when the players are being smuggled off that Karl von Steiner, i.e. the nice Nazi, kind of sees them being smuggled out and just goes, yeah, fair enough, lads.
You've earned it.
Yeah, the better team drew.
And that's the weird sort of ending where they burst through the gates. Mm. Again, shadows of 80s football there. And then the screen turns blue and you get the wonderful credits and the sort of, as you say, the misspelt names in some cases.
It's a nice touch having the kind of roll call at the end of who is who, because I think it's undoubtedly an important part of the film is the cameos from the professional players, so that's kind of acceptable. I do wonder though, the way that the film ends with them being smuggled out again is a little bit Rocky IV. At the end of Rocky IV, you get the triumphant punch in the air and then it freezes and that's the end of it. And then Rocky V, of course, starts with him in the shower in Moscow, punch drunk. And I wonder if they ever do remake Escape to Victory, perhaps the best thing to do would actually just make a sequel where the players are on the bus or getting smuggled through the streets of Paris and then actually explaining what the hell they do next. Because how do you get home from there, lads? You're in your kit. You are full kit wankers. How are you getting home? You're pretty conspicuous. Let's put it that way.
Your white kits and your boots.
Yes. Clattering along on the cobbles. That's not a subtle way to go.
No, you've got an overcoat on, but yeah, we know you still. We know you turn up in shin pants.
They are. I mean, if one of them has got like a massive coat on, that is literally the getting home from Sunday league outfit, isn't it? Not even taking your boots off. I've been in that situation many times, and it was equally arduous, I'm sure.
You see it on the tube of a weekday evening, don't you? Sort of lads with their still with their shin pads on and their AstroTurf trainers.
But with their work coats on because there's no other way of carrying it. It's such an unfortunate look. It's one of the worst looks a human being can have, which is football kit, post-game, but with your work coat on top and then a rucksack on both shoulders. It's such an imbalanced look. It's very Brian Robson being unveiled as player manager.
You've taken smart casual a little bit too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh. And one thing I did notice in the end credits after, I mean, those credits were amusing. You know, you have Kane, Stallone, Pele, Walk, and then the variety of other foreign players they had from Belgium, Netherlands, Norway, and Denmark. And as it goes down towards the end, and you're kind of thinking, because I did read that Gordon Banks kind of trained Stallone a little bit.
Is he in the credits? Name.
No, he's not.
Oh, okay.
Obviously, Pele got himself in there as choreographing.
Oh, my God. Yeah, you know. Okay.
So yeah. Pele has got the same credit for this that Paula Abdul had for The Running Man. It's, we're in that boat. Of course, you know, Pele the
choreograph in The Running Man?
There was a choreograph. You know when the TV show opened and there was a big choreographed sort of dance sequence?
Okay, that makes sense.
That was Paula Abdul.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Pele got himself a credit on this. He probably put that on his Viagra adverts that he's worked in Hollywood. Yeah. And one other crazy credit, and I I assume it's the same one, because underneath where it says thanks or special thanks to XYZ, the New York Cosmos, thanks Michael Jackson. Now, I do wonder if it was that Michael Jackson.
Can't think what his input would have been in any way, shape or form.
I wonder if he's, unless he's helped arrange something. I can't think.
Maybe Kevin O'Callaghan wouldn't have got involved in it if Michael Jackson.
I want a signed copy of...
I'm going to look this up. I'm intent to find out who this Michael Jackson figure is.
I mean, I know it's a fairly commonish name, but even so, it's...
No, I'll find it.
If you've seen the credits of a Hollywood film, it says Michael Jackson, you assume it's that Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
But, yes. Anyway, that was the first leg of Escape to Victory. The Allies have come away with a 4-4 draw, so four away goals. I suppose take it back to wherever the concentration... I made the same mistake as you. Prisoner of war camp.
Tough place to go. Yeah, they're very much
so. Yeah, so fortress. now, and I'll make the... Yeah, just to, I don't want to feed these trolls, but yes, it was a 4-4 draw. It wasn't Escape to Victory.
Yeah, you're right, of course.
Piss off. anyway, Adam, tell us about... You know, you've got a podcast... very much in your on brand. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's Football Cliches. It's part of the Athletics network of podcasts. It's ostensibly a podcast about the language of football, but we talk about pretty much everything that you could classify as a niche interest within football. We've done an episode on football films, obviously, and we talked about Escape to Victory at length in that. These days it's all about trying to get mid-ranking comedians on to talk about football, which is how every podcast maintains its longevity. We talk about very, very silly things in football that you didn't think you cared about, but trust me, you really, really do.
Does that make you the Dara O'Brien of football podcasts?
We're getting him on actually soon. Funnily you should mention him. But yeah, it's incredible the proportion of comedians who support Arsenal. It's absolutely astonishing. What is it? I don't know.
I don't know, because I met him once, weirdly, at Arsenal. Okay. It was at the Guardian did a screening of the Champions League final at the Emirates in, I think it would have been 2011.
Right.
It was at Wembley, and I bumped into him afterwards, and it was the usual amusing anecdote where my friend wanted to take a picture of us, but he had the video camera on, so I've got a video of Dara O'Brien going, no, you've got the camera on, not the video, you know. And I don't have a photograph, but I've got this video.
It's not got a red button, it's recording, not fucking doing anything.
You're on video.
Change it to the other one.
Something about when Arsenal would have been popular at a certain time.
I think it's a metropolitan Guardian reading elite situation, isn't it? Definitely. It's Fever Pitch's far-reaching cultural impact.
I suppose the Guardian offices are in Islington, aren't they?
Yeah, so. I think it's something. It's definitely a snowball effect of something along those lines. Nick Hornby's got a lot to answer for, basically.
Yes, and we've already talked about Fever Pitch, and I did promise... I'd do a High Fidelity episode on the Patreon at some point as well.
Fever Pitch, the film, is truly great, despite its overtly Arsenal-ness. it's a really, really nice film and a very good rom-com in its own right. It quite rightly has no real parallels with the book, and is just a really good, solid mid-90s film. I'd happily talk about that one, though.
Yeah, well, I guess much like Rocky IV, you know, it had a brilliant sporting moment to pin itself around.
One you couldn't have scripted, as they quite often say in football. You really couldn't have had a more convenient moment to anchor a film around than that night at Anfield in 1989.
I'm still waiting for Fever Pitch 2, Aguero.
Fever Pitch 2, maybe with Gallas on the halfway line at Birmingham.
Oh, God, I was at that game.
Oh, mate. Yeah. Terrible.
On that bombshell. Well, Adam, thank you very much for bringing this this copy. We'll get it rewound.
My pleasure. Long time coming.
Yeah. I say we live two roads apart. We're doing this by Zoom because of COVID. I'll drop it off at the video shop, don't you worry. And as is the tradition on the podcast, the number one song in the UK when this was released. This film was released on the 4th of September 1981. God, Liverpool were the European champions. God, horrible glory days. Anyway, the number one song, Soft Cell with Tainted Love. have some of that.
Solid.
Anyway, solid. Adam, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rich.
And done. This podcast is brought to you by executive producers Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Catherine Noe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, Alan Fewings, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, Simon Pegg, Joe Harrison, Anita Singh, Jason Clarkson, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.